In the name of God, most gracious, most compassionate, good evening to everybody. This is the first session that we have under the banner of spiritual wisdom. And the title of my presentation tonight is Spiritual but Not Religious, a Sufi Perspective. Tonight I would like to talk about a new spiritual trend in modern society, which has been gaining traction over the past few decades. A growing number of people, especially among the youth in the modern society, especially in the West, now consider themselves spiritual but not religious. Now, this trend is definitely picking up and gaining momentum. This group of people, this cohort, don't think that it is necessary to be religious in order to have a spiritual and moral lifestyle. They don't see this connection, this necessary connection between spirituality and religion. Now, before the 20th century, the terms religious and spirituality were by and large interchangeable. They were synonymous. So whoever was religious, that person at the same time was spiritual as well, and vice versa. But not anymore. Nowadays, religion and spirituality are separate domains. They are not one and the same thing anymore. And that's why a growing number of people in questionnaires, in surveys, and in interviews, they identify themselves as spiritual but not religious. SBNR for short. So the acronym is SBNR. Spiritual but not religious. I'm going to use this acronym a lot tonight. And so hopefully anytime I say SBNR, I mean spiritual but not religious. Now, the SBNR movement is definitely a challenge to traditional religion. However, this challenge is not without precedence in history. And that's the interesting part about it. Even though in modern society, in the West, we have this new spiritual trend called spiritual but not religious, matter of fact, over 1,000 years ago, a group called Sufis emerged within Islam that by and large had the same perspective on this issue. And in the process, when they battled the prevailing notion of religion, they created a new spiritual tradition that today we call it Sufism. And this tradition obviously created some giants for human spirituality: Attar, Sana'i, Hafiz, Rumi, Muhyiddin ibn Arabi. These are really giants in human spirituality, and all of these figures emerged from the Islam's Sufi tradition. Now, I think the Sufi tradition and the spiritual but not religious movement in the West have some in common. And the Sufi tradition, I also believe, can offer a lot of great insights to this SBNR movement in the West. By the way, tonight I'm going to use the terms Sufi and mystic interchangeably. Right? Sufi and mystic, I'm going to use them interchangeably, even though there are differences between the two terms. Not all mystics are considered to be Sufis. However, in the West, almost all great Muslim mystics such as Rumi are called Sufis. So that's why I'm going to use that familiar term in my presentation tonight. Now, before I delve into the body of my presentation about what Sufism can contribute to the modern SBNR movement, let me spend a few minutes and talk about this new movement, this spiritual movement in the West, by using some quantitative data. So let's talk numbers about this group of people that are growing in numbers in the West. In 2012, 3 years ago, The Pew Research Center, which is a very famous organization in the U.S., conducted a survey in order to examine religious affiliation in American society. Religious affiliation in American society. Their findings are quite insightful, and I'm going to share with you some of their findings because they are very relevant to what I am going to present to you tonight. The Pew Research Center found some familiar themes in their study. Number one, the U.S. society remains a highly religious country, particularly when you compare it to the other advanced industrial nations around the world, such as Britain, Germany, France, Spain, and so forth. Let me share some numbers with you. 58% of Americans say that religion is very important in their lives. I think this speaks volumes. 58% of the American public say that religion is a very important part of their life. 76% of the American public say that prayer is an important part of their daily life. 76% of people. That's a huge number in a modern society. But, and here's the big but, the number of Americans who do not identify with any particular religion is also on the rise. Right? So that group, the group of people in the U.S. who do not identify with any traditional religion is also on the rise. As it turns out, nearly one-fifth of Americans are religiously unaffiliated. One out of five Americans does not associate with any particular religion. That translates to almost 46 million people in this country. 46 million people. What is more significant is that the proportion of the younger people in this group is higher than the proportion of the older people. One out of three young person in the U.S. fall in this category. This should be very alarming for traditional religions, for Christianity, Islam, Judaism, so on and so forth. This is an alarming trend for traditional religions. Now, these 46 million people are not atheists, and that's the interesting part of it. These 46 million people who do not identify with any traditional religion, they are not atheists. Far from that. Two-thirds of them, 68% of this group, say that they do believe in God. So these people are not atheists. 68% of them say they believe in God. 21% say that they actually pray every day. Isn't that interesting? They believe in God. They pray every day, but they do not subscribe to any religion. So this shift in the American attitudes toward religion is not a net gain for atheism, but it is a net loss for traditional religion. I guess that's the bottom line. And what is perhaps more significant is 37% of this group considered themselves spiritual but not religious. So 37% of this group considered themselves part of the SBNR movement, spiritual but not religious. This translates to 7% of the American public. This group is bigger than atheists, bigger than Muslims, and bigger than Jews in American society. And all indications are that their numbers are growing, especially amongst the youth. So these people do want to have a connection with God. They want to have a relationship with God. They are very much interested in having a moral lifestyle which fosters the connection and relationship with God. However, they do not affiliate with an organized religion. So what does organized religion mean? Because I'm going to use this term a lot tonight. Organized religion is also known as institutional religion. It is religion as a social institution, which is characterized by three things. Number one, official doctrines and dogma. Secondly, codifications of practices and rules, right, like prayers. So everything is codified. And perhaps more importantly, in this type of religion, there is a bureaucracy, a hierarchical leadership structure that we call the clergy. So that's what we mean by organized religion. So, now let me pose a few questions. And these questions are very important, especially for people who still belong to the leadership of traditional religions. Why do these folks, why are they turned off by organized religion? What do these people see as wrong with traditional religion? Why do these folks turn their backs to religion but not to God? These are very critical questions that I believe need to be investigated and talked about. We cannot really definitively answer these questions because we don't have a lot of concrete quantitative data to make any meaningful conclusion. But if you read articles written by the advocates of this movement, or if you talk to these folks, the SBNRs, in person, I'm sure you're going to find and get a glimpse at root causes of their dissatisfactions with organized religion. Let me share with you four or five complaints that this group of people have with organized religions. By the way, these folks can be your sons and daughters. They could be the youth in your neighborhood. So these are the complaints that this group of people who believe in God, many of them pray, but they do not believe in organized religion. These are their main complaints. The first complaint that they have, and it should be familiar to a lot of you, is that according to the SBNRs, too much emphasis is given to doctrines and dogma. In organized religion, faith tends to be reduced to doctrines and theories about God. So people end up worshipping theories about God rather than God himself. And I guess we can all relate to that. So there is a false yardstick for people to measure their faith. People in organized religion tend to think that because they embrace certain theories about God, they have very strong faith. They have a very strong relationship with God. And what is worse, people tend to associate faith with dogma. They fight over dogma. Christians attack Muslims because they don't have the right theories about God. Muslims attack Jews or Hindus because they don't have the right theories about God. So people end up fighting over dogma, doctrines, and theories about God, which at the end of the hour are all human-made. We human beings create these theories, right? Some of them are right, some of them are wrong. Some of them are accurate, some of them are inaccurate. Unfortunately, we idolize the theories that we create about God, and then we worship our own creation. So that's the first complaint that the SBNRs have about organized religion. The second one, too much emphasis is given to rules, rituals, and formal practices. In other words, traditional religion tends to reduce faith to formalities. So people mistakenly measure their faithfulness to God with the number of times they pray every day. The more they pray, they think that they have a stronger faith because they equate faith in God with formalities and prayers. And people are content that they have reached their goals just because they pray on time and they do their prayers according to the book. The third complaint is that religious leaders and organizations tend to be extremely concerned with money and power. And this is a big problem actually these days. Religious leaders and organizations tend to be very concerned with money and power. As examples, SPNRs would invite us to consider evangelical Christians. Much of the bloodshed around the world these days, believe it or not, is caused by these evangelical Christians that just go around the world and push Western governments to attack other countries to create a path for them, an entry for them into these societies to evangelize, to bring non-Christians into the flock of Christianity. Also consider the Shi'i clergy in Iran today. Right? They are so preoccupied with power and politics that they have forgotten their traditional role in society. The Taliban in Afghanistan, also the self-described Islamic State, these jihadis, they are all examples of the bad version of religion that we see these days, a religion that is preoccupied with money and power. So, in other words, according to the SPNRs, traditional religion ultimately degenerates into an economic and political enterprise. So religion becomes a tool to control other people, a tool to control society. Now, this is a very, very sharp critique, which means religion is an instrument and a lever of power. And it's just spirituality 101. Spirituality and power do not mix. Spirituality is a domain where you want to be free, not controlled. Now, I'm going to share with you one more complaint that these SPNRs have about organized religion, then I'm going to stop talking about their complaints. The fourth complaint is that traditional religious upbringing makes people close-minded and intolerant. Probably many of us who come from very traditional families can relate to this complaint. The traditional religious upbringing and education tends to make people very intolerant and very close-minded. Well, you might ask, why? What is it in the traditional religious upbringing that makes people intolerant? Well, it's because each religion views itself as having a monopoly over truth and salvation. Isn't that true? Every single religion in the world has this view. I am right, everybody else is wrong. Followers of my religion are saved, everybody else is damned. Well, if you have this kind of monopolistic view on piety, on righteousness, and on salvation, it's obvious that you're going to be very susceptible to discrimination, to bigotry, and also warfare. History is filled with horrific crimes committed by religious zealots in the name of God, just because they think that they are lieutenants of God on earth. God has given them the authority to bring everyone else in the fold. Well, to make a long story short, according to the SPNRs, religion tend to be fixated on dogma and practices. And as long as it's concerned about dogma and religious practices, rituals and rules, it will not make people spiritual. It will not even make people more ethical, right? Because it is more obsessed, because traditional religion is more obsessed with what to do rather than how to be. So it is more concerned with the right way of doing your prayers than how to lead your life. Instead of challenging people to face their limitations, instead of challenging people to face their biases and prejudices and overcoming them, traditional religion actually reinforces those biases and prejudices. And now suddenly God endorses human limitations, human biases and prejudices. The spiritual and not religious folks say that what we need is spirituality and not religion. Because the spirituality doesn't have dogma. It doesn't have formal practices. It doesn't have a bureaucracy called the clergy. Spirituality is a lifelong journey to enrich our soul. It is a path for self-development. It's a path for character modification and character transformation. So this is what we need. Rather than, let me repeat, according to these folks, rather than focusing on dogma, rather than fighting over theories about God and the right way of praying, we need to follow a path that would make us better human beings, more spiritual, a path that would enrich our soul and help us be better people. This is what we need to do according to this new spiritual trend, which is gaining momentum in the modern world. And it is my assessment that this trend will kick in the Islamic world as well. In Iran, Pakistan, you know, Turkey, I think in not too distant of the future, you will see this trend emerging as well. Matter of fact, in Iran today, the government is actively persecuting followers of this trend. In Farsi, what does the Iranian government call these folks? Followers of false mysticism, Irfanhai Kazib. Because this is the trend that is also picking up in Iran. Okay, enough about, you know, this SBNR movement in the modern world. Now let me talk about a similar trend that appeared in the Islamic world over 1,000 years ago. Again, even though the spiritual but not religious is a modern day movement in America, which is a predominantly Christian country, a movement with similar underpinnings, with similar aspirations and outlook and persuasions started in Islam, in the very first century of Islam that ultimately led to the creation of Sufism. Now, Sufism is all about spirituality. Sufism is the spiritual tradition of Islam. If you ask me, give me a definition for Sufism. Sufism is the spiritual and the ethical dimensions of Islam. If you're interested in Islamic spirituality, you need to really read Rumi. You need to read Hafez. Don't ever go to, you know, a seminary in Qom or in Basra or in Najaf in order to learn about Islamic spirituality. You can learn about Islamic law a lot from those people. You can learn a lot about Islamic discourse or what we call kalam. But authentic spirituality in Islam was really promoted by Muslim Sufis or mystics, as I'm going to elaborate tonight. For Sufis, at its core, spirituality is having a personal experience of God or divine. Let me repeat. If you ask a Sufi, what is spirituality? They're going to tell you that it is a personal and immediate experience of God. Experiencing something that is bigger than myself. Experiencing somebody that lies beyond the boundaries of myself. And when you have this experience of God, then God will affect you in many different forms. If you have this experience yourself, you will have certain emotions, certain feelings. The feeling of love, sorrow, dread, joy, gratitude, sorrow. These are all the kind of different ways that God will affect you if you experience God. Now, Sufis want this experience to be of their own. They don't want to glorify and cherish the experiences of other people of God, including prophets of God. Somebody like Rumi would tell you that, yes, it is great that somebody like the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heavens, or what Muslims call Mi'raj. It's great. It's awesome. But what does it have to do with me? I need to follow his footstep to ascend to heaven myself. Yes, the Prophet Muhammad had definitely some immediate personal experiences of God. If you read the first verses that were revealed to Prophet Muhammad in the Holy Quran, the Prophet actually experienced those. It wasn't that God, you know, whispered in his ear. He saw, he had a vision, all of those, right? That was his experience of God. So Sufis would say, we want to do the same thing ourselves. We want to have a personal experience of God. And we want this experience to affect our whole being, to affect our mind, our soul, our thoughts, our mood, our emotions. We want this experience to overwhelm us. Let me give you a little bit of a background about Sufism so that you can see the relevance of the Sufi tradition and the modern SPNR movement in the West. Most scholars trace the origin of Sufism to Hassan Basri, who lived in modern-day Basra in Iraq in 7th century AD, almost 1300 or 1400 years ago. Most people credit him with Sufism. Now, early Sufis were very dissatisfied with the direction that Muslim society had taken after the death of the Prophet Muhammad. The new Muslim political establishment, the new political class, was preoccupied with building an empire. This new political class that emerged after the Prophet Muhammad was more interested in empire building, right? So they started invading other countries. They invaded Iran. They invaded Egypt. Why? Because they wanted to build an empire in the name of Islam. That was their major project. In order to justify their expansionism, they drew upon theological concepts in order to embellish their political agenda. This also rings holds true today. People in the Islamic world that have some political agenda and they have some grand design to create an empire, they draw upon Islamic themes, Quranic themes, in order to justify their imperial building project. The new Muslim political class, the political establishment, called their expansionism jihad. So in their mind, jihad to them meant expansion, bringing other people to the fold of Islam. So, according to early Sufis, the old-fashioned land grab, pillage, and plunder was given a religious makeup. That's what it was. Now, this was a sea change, because the religion of Islam, the Islam that Prophet Muhammad had introduced to the world, which was essentially a spiritual and ethical paradigm, it quickly morphed into a political ideology in the service of the emerging imperial power. It became a tool in the hands of the new political class in order to expand their empire, in what is known as the Islamic Caliphate, the Umayyad and the Abbasid, or in Farsi, Khilafat-e Umayyad wa Abbasid. So these people drew upon theological concepts such as jihad to justify their expansionism. So the simple life and the piety of the Prophet Muhammad's time was quickly replaced with rampant materialism. It was replaced with luxury consumption amongst the ruling classes and also corruption. So this was the backdrop against which the early Sufis emerged. The likes of Hassan Basri, Ibrahim Adham, Rabi'i, these folks were more interested in developing their souls rather than expanding the realm of political Islam. They were more interested in helping themselves rather than bringing others, sometimes by force, to the fold of Islam. Let me also make it very clear here. These early Sufis, they were also very much interested in jihad. They also believed that jihad was a very important obligation, very important duty. Whereas the official Islam that the caliphate promoted described jihad in terms of war on others, Sufis viewed jihad as a war on the inner demons. It was a war against the inner demons that we all have. The Satan, as they would call it, the Satan that exists in every single one of us. For them, jihad was a struggle against the demands of the carnal soul, or nafs al-ammarah in the Quran. When jihad was a struggle against the dictates of the lower self, or the ego. So clearly this Sufi vision was at odds with the religion that the clergymen and the muftis preached and promoted, and the Islamic State endorsed and supported. Now, I don't want to give you the impression that all Sufis are alike. You know, far from that. Islamic Sufism has not been uniform in theory or practice. Sufism definitely evolved over time. It matured. And when it matured, it finally gave humanity the likes of Hafiz, Rumi, Shams al-Tabrizi, and others. Now, the history of Sufism is not the subject of our discussion tonight, but I want to explore one aspect of the Sufi experience that is quite relevant to the modern world. It is very relevant to this SPNR movement, the spiritual but not religious movement in the West. So for the rest of my presentation, that's what I'm going to talk about. This aspect of the Sufi experience that I think is very, very illuminating to the spiritual youth in the modern world. You see, what is fascinating, in my opinion, is that the Sufis and the SPNRs see things eye to eye when it comes to organized religion. Their attitudes about the traditional organized religion is by and large the same. That's why probably Rumi is so popular amongst the SPNRs in the West. Those who consider themselves spiritual but not religious in the West, they really love Rumi. As probably some of you know, Rumi's Mathnavi was bestseller in the U.S. a couple of years ago. So he's extremely popular amongst this SPNR movement. Matter of fact, there are many people in the West who believe Rumi was spiritual but not religious. Are they wrong? In my opinion, not entirely. There is a ring of truth to this claim. Rumi unequivocally says that he is a follower of the religion of love. Several times in his masterpiece Mathnavi, he says that I am a follower of the religion of love. Before I give you the poems, remember, the religion of love doesn't have dogma. It doesn't have formalities. It doesn't have guardian. It doesn't have clergymen, right? Religion of love. دین من از عشق زنده بودن است. دین من از عشق زنده بودن است. زندگی زین جان و تن ننگ من است. My religion is to live through love. My religion is to live through love. Life through this body is my shame. ملت عشق از همه دینها جداست. عاشقان را ملت و مذهب خداست. Love's creed is separate from all religions. The creed and denomination of lovers is God. In other words, lovers worship God and not theories about God. Essentially, that's what he's saying. So, Sufis and modern SBNRs dismiss traditional religion in terms of spirituality. But there is one major difference between the two. Sufis and the modern SBNRs differ in one important respect. What is it? And that's very important for our discussion tonight. You see, modern SBNRs critiqued organized religion and ultimately decided to abandon religion altogether. Sufis, on the other hand, they also critiqued traditional religion. However, they opted to stay within Islam. They never abandoned Islam. However, they created their own unique appreciation and version of Islam. A version which sharply contrasts with the mainstream or traditional version of Islam that we see on daily basis around the world. So, the Sufi Islam is very different than the official Islam that is sanctioned and preached by the clergymen and the muftis. In fact, because the Sufis have been so different in their view of Islam, throughout history, they have often been persecuted in the Islamic societies, especially whenever the clergymen have held the levers of political power, such as today's Iran. In Iran today, Sufis are actively persecuted by the government. Now, let me share with you the tenets of the Sufi thought as it relates to this dichotomy of spirituality versus religion. What do they have to teach us in the modern world? Modern marketing teaches us that if you want to succeed in the marketplace, it is not good enough to have a great product, right? You also need to have a brand. Without a brand, you cannot really sell the best product that you may have. What does brand mean? Brand is a design that identifies and differentiates your product from all the other similar products in the marketplace, right? So branding is all about differentiation, product differentiation. Guess what? Sufis were very mindful of branding. They also worked very hard to create a brand of a spirituality for themselves. They lived in a religious society, so they needed to differentiate their version of religion from all the other brands that were available in their society. What are the major features of the Sufi brand? Let me give you very quickly, in a nutshell, four or five major features of the Sufi brand of spirituality. Number one, the Sufi brand is esoteric. Esoteric, meaning what? It's inward looking. Rather than looking outward, Sufis always look inward. Most religious people around the world, as soon as you say God, what do? They look up. When you say God to a Sufi, he looks inside. right? And I'm going to tell you what that means in a second. So the Sufi tradition is more interested in the inner life and inner experiences than the outside world. Not that the outside world is not important, but if you have a decadent inside, guess what? If you become active in politics, you're going to project your decadence to the world outside. It is fruitless to try to correct the problems outside when I have all sorts of issues inside me. So that's what it means by being esoteric and looking inward. The second feature of the Sufi spirituality, it is focused on enriching the soul. So it is very focused on enriching the soul and building a spiritual and moral character. Number three, the Sufi brand of spirituality is anchored in love and compassion towards all God's creation. Right? Love and compassion towards not only all human beings, but all of God's creation. And the other important feature, in my opinion, is that Sufis aspire to unite and not divide humanity. So their project is to build a bridge, to bring people of different ethnicities, colors, creeds, and backgrounds together rather than dividing them and drawing sharp lines among them. This makes Sufis extremely tolerant. Probably now we can appreciate what Rumi means by the religion of love. The religion of love has all of these attributes. If you have love in your heart, you're going to project it to the outside world. Even sometimes you have to fight somebody who has invaded you, you would never hate that person. You hate what he does, but you never hate the person. But if somebody doesn't have love and compassion in his heart, when he fights, he hates the person that he is fighting against. He's not going to have any mercy against that person. Now, as I mentioned before, Sufis did not abandon religion altogether. But they went to a great length in order to differentiate their spiritual system from ordinary religion. How did they do it? How did the Sufis differentiate their brand from the ordinary traditional religion that existed in their societies? Well, Sufis started off by slicing and dicing religion. They said, no religion in the world, be it Islam, Christianity, Judaism, no religion is a homogeneous whole. Every religion, every authentic religion, at a minimum, has three distinct layers. Right? Every religion at least has three distinct layers. I can give you the analogy of an onion. When you slice an onion, what do you see? You see layers and rings inside it, right? Sufis viewed religion pretty much the same way. They said if you slice a religion, such as Christianity or Islam, at a minimum, you will see three different layers. What are these three different layers? I'm going to say it first in Farsi, because that's the original language most of them spoke. Shariat, tariqat, haqiqat. Shariat, tariqat, haqiqat. These are the three distinct layers of religion. Shariat, in English, we call it sharia, right? Today, typically whenever we say sharia, people think of rules, rituals, and basically religious law. In the Sufi usage, sharia means religious knowledge, which also includes knowledge of the sacred law or divine law, right? So sharia means knowledge. So this is the The outermost layer of religion is Sharia or knowledge. The ring or the layer inside it is called tariqat or path or way. And the innermost layer is called haqiqat or the truth. So knowledge, path, truth. These are the three interconnected layers of religion. Now Sufis attributed their classification to a hadith or a saying of the Prophet Muhammad. And you find this hadith used a lot in Sufi literature. Ash-shari'atu aqwali wa tariqatu afali wa al-haqiqatu ahwali. My teachings are Sharia. My practices are the path. But the truth is my inner spiritual state. So these are the three layers of religion according to Muslim Sufis. In other words, when someone embraces a religion, be it Islam or Christianity, she should first learn certain teachings about God, about afterlife, basically about do's and don'ts, prayers, rituals. The next step is to act upon those teachings, to act upon the newfound knowledge, right? To live in accordance to those teachings and practices. This is now the second layer, which is called tariqat, or path. But even though the teachings and practices are instrumental, they are not ends in themselves. They are not the end game. They are not the end results. Neither the teachings nor the practices constitute the truth of religion. Now, what is the truth? In Prophet Muhammad's usage of the term, truth does not mean philosophical truth. Truth doesn't mean the understanding the true meanings of the Quranic verses, for example, or the true meanings of daily prayers or the annual fasting during Ramadan. That has nothing to do with the truth of religion. When we talk about the truth of religion, to most of us it means having the true understanding of the verses of the Holy Quran. That is not what Sufis mean by the word truth. Truth means realizing those teachings and practices in your soul. Realizing those teachings and practices in your character and in your daily life. So truth is not a type of mental awareness, but it is a type of being. So religious truth is a type of being, not a type of mental awareness. So in authentic religion, the ultimate truth, the final product, is existential transformation. A person of faith should aim to acquire a divine character. A person of faith, what is the project? What is the most important project of a person of faith? Is to realize God in his character, to realize God in his soul, in his behavior, to incorporate God and godliness in his or her daily life. Or as the Holy Quran puts it, to take on the color of God. That's what faith is all about. That is the truth of religion. The truth in religion is not doing your prayers on time. The truth in religion is taking on the color of God or godliness in your daily life. To put it differently, when religion asks you to do something, it is called Sharia. And when you do it, it is called tariqat, or the path. And when that teaching and practice elevates you to to a higher state of being, when it makes you a better person, that is the truth. Do you all understand now what truth means? So that is the truth of religion according to Sufi Islam. In his introduction to book 5 of Masnavi, Rumi uses three analogies to teach us the interdependency of these three layers. This is absolutely beautiful. Rumi uses three analogies in his introduction to book 5 of Masnavi in order to teach us the interdependencies between these three layers of religion. He uses the analogy of candle, also medicine, the science of medicine, and also alchemy, or in Farsi, kimya. Now, for those of you who don't know what alchemy means, alchemy is the forerunner of modern chemistry. In medieval times, people believed that there was a magic substance that could convert base materials, base metals, into gold. So if you would take a piece of copper and rub it into this magic material or substance called alchemy or kimya, it would turn into gold. Obviously, that magic substance was really magic because nobody ever found that substance. But this term alchemy or kimya is used often in Rumi's Masnavi and other Sufi literature. So let me read the English translation of this paragraph in introduction to book 5 of Masnavi. Again, Rumi is trying to teach us the interdependency of those three layers of religion: Shari'at, Tariqat, Haqiqat. Sharia is like a candle showing the way. Unless you gain possession of the candle, there is no wayfaring, no traveling. And when you have come on to the way, your wayfaring is the path, tariqat. And when you have reached the journey's end, that is the truth, haqiqat. In short, Sharia is like learning the theory of alchemy from a teacher or a book. And the path, tariqat, is like making use of chemicals and rubbing copper into alchemy, and the truth is like the transformation of copper into gold. Those who know alchemy rejoice in their knowledge of it, saying, "We know the theory of this science." And those who practice it rejoice in their practice of it, saying, "We perform such works." And those who have experienced the reality rejoice in the reality, saying, "We have become gold and are delivered from the theory and practice of alchemy." Or Sharia may be compared to learning the science of medicine, and the path, tariqat, to regulating one's diet in accordance with the science of medicine and taking remedies, and the truth, haqiqat, to gaining health everlasting and becoming independent of them both. So, did you all follow what he was saying? So take the example, let me just repeat, take the example of medicine. Some people have the knowledge of medicine, and they are very proud of it. They say, "We know all of this science." Then there are those who use this science in terms of remedy to get better. And yet there is a third group of people who have actually gotten well. Now they are delivered from the science and the practice of medicine. They have reached a destination. They have internalized the end result, basically. So that's what Rumi is saying. So, in a nutshell, I think by now it should be clear to you what Sufis regard as a major flaw in traditional religion. Most religious people tend to get stuck in the first two layers of religion. They get stuck in the layer of Sharia, the religious knowledge, and the law or the practices. they never reach the final destination, which is the truth. In other words, taking on the color of God, realizing God in their character, in their soul, and in their daily life. That is the problem. Rumi illustrates this flaw, getting stuck in the first two layers, in a story in Book 1 of Mathnavi. He uses the analogy of collecting wheat in agrarian societies. In modern society, we can use the analogy of depositing money in a savings account. Rumi says, imagine that for a long period of time, you go into your bank every week and you deposit a little bit of money in your savings account. Years later, you go to your local bank and you want to find out what your balance is. So you ask the bank teller, how much is in my savings account? The bank teller looks it up and then says, zero. Nothing. And you say, what happened? I deposited a lot of money over the years in my account, and now you're telling me my balance is zero? Did somebody steal all of my funds from my savings account? Now let's hear it from Rumi. Again, he is using the analogy of collecting wheat. ما در این انبار گندم می کنیم. گندم جمع آمده گم می کنیم. می نیندیشیم آخر ما به هوش. کین خلل در گندم است از مکر موش. موش تا در انبار ما حفره زده است و از فنش انبار ما ویران شده است. اول ای جان دفع شر موش کن. وانگهان در جمع گندم جوش کن. گر نموشی دوز در انبار ماست، گندم اعمال 40 ساله کجاست؟ And here's the English translation. We are putting wheat in this barn, and then we are losing the wheat that has been garnered. Why, after all, don't we consider with intelligent mind that this damage to the wheat arises from the deceitfulness of the mouse? Since the mouse has made a hole in our barn has been ravaged by its guile. O soul, in the first place, avert the mischief of the mouse, and then show fervor in garnering the wheat. If there is no thievish mouse in the barn, where is the wheat of 40 years' works of devotion? So basically Rumi is saying that you have been praying for 40 years. You have been observing all the religious laws and practices to the word. You have been praying on time 5 times a day, and doing it exactly the way muftis and the jurists ask you to do. But if those observances have not made any difference in your lifestyle, if all those observances have not made an iota of difference in your behavior, shouldn't you ask yourself, what's the use of all those prayers? What is the use of my devotion to these observances, to these teachings? If after 40 years of devotion to dogma and practices and rituals, you are still selfish, you are still arrogant, you still lie, you still trample on the rights of others, if you still have no love and compassion in your heart, shouldn't you ask yourself, what is the point of all of these devotion to rituals, to practices, to these teachings? What is the point of my devotion to the Holy Quran? Shouldn't you ask you this? That is the question that Rumi invites every single one of us to ask. The Sufi literature uses another analogy that is very insightful. They use the analogy of a walnut. A walnut has two distinct parts, A walnut is composed of a fairly hard outer shell and a kernel that is inside it, right? The shell of the walnut has a very important function. What is the function of the shell? To protect and preserve the kernel, right? But when you buy the kernel, do you buy it for the shell or the kernel that is inside it? That's a question to ask. Religion, according to Sufis, has exactly the same thing. A very thick shell and also a soft kernel inside it. Sheikh Mahmud Shabistari, another renowned Sufi, perhaps said it the best. Shari'at poost, maghzamat haqiqat, miyan inu an bashat tariqat. Sharia is the shell. Kernel is the truth. In between lies the path. It's so beautiful, so eloquent, and so simple. Sharia is the shell. Truth is the kernel. In between lies the path. In other words, religious practices, observances, rules, rituals, they constitute the shell. Character transformation is the kernel, is the truth. We need to transform our soul and character if we consume the kernel of religion. You know what the trouble is? Most religious people, they buy walnut, they eat the shell, and they throw away the kernel. That is the unfortunate thing. That is the problem. So, we start from the shell, and here is probably the insight which is very important to the SBNR movement in the modern world. Because right now, I guess I'm addressing one of the shortcomings of the spiritual but not religious movement in the West, right? We start, according to the Sufis, we start from the shell in the hopes of ultimately reaching the kernel. Between the shell and the kernel lies a path. Without trekking on this path, you will never reach the kernel. You will never reach the truth. We start with Sharia, but we should never get stuck in it. Be always mindful that there is a kernel beyond the shell. Now, this walnut analogy is extremely useful for our purposes. Relative to the kernel, the shell has less of a value. It is not valueless. It is not useless. The shell has a very important use. What is the use of it? To protect and preserve the kernel. But if you compare the relative importance of the two to the person who will ultimately consume the walnut, which is more important, the shell or the kernel? Obviously, the kernel. So I guess this is the wisdom that Muslim Sufis have for the modern-day SBNR movement. There is a reason for a shell in all world religions. Love doesn't grow on a tree. Even if you develop love in your heart, you need to protect it. You need certain practices in your daily life which reinforces that love. Otherwise, it will wither away. Sufis, if they have one critique of modern version of Christianity that you see in the West, is exactly that. They would say, yes, you really emphasize love, and that's great. It is great that you celebrate and cherish love and compassion. But you know what? Without having a protective layer, this love cannot last in anybody's heart. You need to have a protective layer. That protective layer is nothing but those religious practices. So let me close with a final thought. There are, according to Sufis, there are perils on the path of spirituality, especially the spirituality that we see in the modern world, this SBNR movement, the spiritual but not religious movement. They face a lot of dangers. these folks do not want to be part of any established tradition. They want to shop around for spiritual insights. They want to shop around and collect bits and pieces of spiritual insights from Sufism, Hinduism, Buddhism, so on and so forth. But they do not want to commit to any tradition. There are two problems with this approach. The first problem is a theoretical one. It is very, very difficult to assemble the various bits and pieces of spiritual philosophy into a meaningful whole. Right? It's very difficult. You see, theology is a very complex project. What is the job of a good theologian? To make all the bits and pieces connect together in a meaningful way so that you can relate to it. Now, if you start shopping for spiritual wisdom, you take a little bit from this tradition, a little bit from that tradition, it's very hard to put all of this together and make a meaningful whole. The second problem with this approach that the SBNRs have is actually practical. It's very dangerous to be eclectic. In other words, pick bits and pieces from different traditions. Why? Because there is a danger in cherry picking. Cherry picking, meaning what? You are at risk of picking only the stuff that are easy and leaving behind things that are very important yet very difficult. Guess what? We humans, by nature, like comfort. Nobody wants to face hardship. We want to be comfortable. This is true in spirituality, right? But if you want to go beyond feeling good, and you actually want to be good, you have to face a lot of hardships in life. No pain, no gain. So the problem is a lot of us, or a lot of people who are part of this SBNR movement, they end up just feeling good when they read Rumi. But to be good and to do good, we have to face a lot of hardships. It is difficult to be spiritual. It is difficult to be ethical. Right? So that's the challenge. The spirituality, in a nutshell, is easier said than done. Perhaps Hafez, the great Iranian poet and mystic, said it the best. چو عاشق می شدم گفتم که بردم گوهر مقصود ندانستم که این دریا چه موج خونفشان دارد. As I was falling in love, I said to myself, I have carried off the jewel of my desire. I knew not what blood-scattering waves this sea has. See, initially when I was falling in love, everything was gorgeous, everything was joyful, everything was so beautiful. I didn't know how hard it is to maintain a loving relationship. So, in a nutshell, if somebody wants to be truly spiritual and build a spiritual character, build a spiritual personality and lifestyle, that person will have to face a lot of hardships. The danger is, if you do cherry picking, you're gonna, as soon as you see hardships, you're gonna abandon that and you're gonna go to the next tree to basically pick the low-hanging fruits. So this is the advice probably that Sufi Muslims have for the modern spiritual but not religious folks. To reiterate, Sufis have great sympathy for the modern SBNR movement. They have a lot of sympathy with the modern folks who see a lot of problem with organized traditional religion. At the same time, if these younger folks want to be truly spiritual and truly ethical, they need to find a way to accommodate practices in their spirituality, otherwise they're not going to go very far in their project. I hope tonight's presentation was of some value to all of you, and thank you very much for your time. God bless you.